From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's here and now. And it's finally here, Election Day 2020. More than 100 million Americans have already voted, according to the U.S. Elections Project. And as many as 60 million more are expected at the polls today. It could be the highest voter turnout in U.S. history.
It is a momentous day in an unprecedented year, a campaign in a pandemic, and in the wake of racial reckoning. We are living history, so let's get a sense of what it feels like. And to begin, we turn to Wisconsin, a state Donald Trump won in 2016, but where polls show Joe Biden has taken the lead. WUWM reporter Taryn Powell joins us live now from Washington Park Library, a central polling station in Milwaukee. Taryn, what's turnout like?
Well, so far, it hasn't been too crowded since I've been here. Steady flow of people, not too long of wait times. It really seems like people are, you know, in and out almost in 5 minutes. But there are folks out here who have, you know, shirts they're giving out, free snacks and everything. So, yeah, it's pretty good vibes here.
Good vibes. And we know there are really long lines elsewhere. So that's good. It's, you know, just going in and out. But do you know what people, you know, what's bringing them to the polls? What issues are top of mind?
Yeah, I've spoken to a few people, a number of issues that have brought them to the polls. People are concerned with jobs, education, making sure, you know, there's adequate education and equal access for all children. Some people, of course, you know, being that we're in the midst of, you know, a global pandemic, folks are concerned with the pandemic response, and that people are sick and, you know, losing their jobs. I even, I spoke to an elder voter who is concerned about Social Security. You know, he says he's been going around and, you know, bringing people to the polls with him and urging them to vote because it's just a tough time.
Yeah, very sweet. WWM reporter Taryn Powell, live from Milwaukee. Thank you, Taryn.
Thank you.
Let's head to Pennsylvania now, another highly contested state where more than 2.4 million mail-in ballots have already been received, according to the Pennsylvania Department of State. And it's where President Trump has cast doubt over election security. And for more, we're joined by Emily Bazelon, reporter for the New York Times Magazine. She's joining us from Pajonk Square in Philadelphia. And Emily, I know there are long lines already reported in North and West Philadelphia. What's it like where you are today, and are you seeing any issues arise this morning?
So I was in North and West Philadelphia this morning, and there were definitely long lines. People were standing in them patiently. There was music playing in one of the school parking lots where I was. There was one polling station that didn't open on time at 7 o'clock. They were missing some equipment, and so it took them 15 or 20 minutes to open, and people were, you know, eager for them to get going. But it's been very peaceful in Philadelphia as far as I've seen.
Philadelphia beefed up its election task force as a means of dealing with voter complaints. Are they out there today, and what issues are they preparing to handle?
Yeah, they have a hotline, and they're taking phone calls, and they are ready to handle any issues that arise if they hear about any kind of voter intimidation. So far, though, I don't think that any reports of that have come in, as far as I know.
Yeah, very quickly, what will happen to ballots that come in after tonight but are still postmarked November 3rd?
Well, I mean, according to the current court rulings, people in Pennsylvania have until November 6th as long as their ballots are postmarked today. So in other words, there's a little grace time for the mail. But those ballots, according to the attorney general, are an order from him. They're being segregated from the other ballots just in case there's any court challenge to them after the fact. And the U.S. Supreme Court, while it did not stop the state from allowing people to allowing these ballots to be counted until November 6th, they didn't completely close off the case. So sort of extra caution, there's this question of whether they could be held back later.
That's Emily Bazelon, reporter with the New York Times Magazine in Philadelphia. Thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, a quick visit to Nevada, a state that President Trump hopes to win despite Biden's lead in the polls. Politics reporter Paul Boger of KUNR is in Spanish Springs, a suburb just north of Sparks. And Paul, this is a swing suburb that leans conservative. So what are you seeing and hearing?
Right. So, Robin, what I've been seeing this morning is voters who were mainly distrustful of the state's mail-in ballot process. Just earlier this summer, the legislature passed a law sending a ballot to every registered voter in the state, every active registered voter in the state. So the folks that I've spoken to this morning are the folks that have been distrustful of that process. I got here about 6 in the morning, and there was already a line starting to form. And that line grew to about 100, 150 people as the polls were opening. Since then, we've seen a lot of those lines clear out. But that's here in Spanish Springs. We are getting reports of longer lines elsewhere in Washoe County. And just for your edification, Washoe County is that swingier county in Nevada, whereas Clark County, Las Vegas, tends to be much more Democratic.
And when you say swingier, you mean politically. And just, you got just a couple seconds here. Yeah. What else do you want us to know about what you're seeing today? Just in a couple seconds.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we're hearing is that these have been solid Trump supporters. They think he's doing a great job. They're not worried about the pandemic. They're worried more about the economy, and they think that's where their vote's going to go.
Yeah. Oh, KUNR reporter Paul Boger in Spanish Springs, Nevada. Thank you so much.
Well, the past can often give us a window into the future. And for that perspective on this election day, we're joined by Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. And Julian, let's start with turnout. Even before today, we've already seen unprecedented levels of mail-in voting and early voting in person in many states. How does this compare with past elections?
Well, it's a huge difference. We haven't had this before. We have over 100 million Americans who voted by mail or in person. That's about twice the early vote in 2016, 70% of the entire vote in 2016, and we're seeing that in specific states. So it's pretty dramatic how people have already cast their ballot even before we reach today.
Yeah, something else I'm thinking a lot about, though. We're in the midst of a pandemic. More than 200,000 people have died from COVID-19. We have an administration unlike any other. Millions of people are out of work. How does all of this impact the surge in early voting we've seen this election?
Well, it's essential, I think, in two ways. First, people feel the weight of this being a historic election. So I think feelings are very intense about the president, about the situation and the conditions that we face. And second, the pandemic has created since last March real fears about what election day would be like. So I think a lot of people not only wanted to register their vote as soon as they could, but they wanted to do it before they would face long lines and any uncertainties of voting day in terms of catching this virus. So I think both have been essential to why we're seeing these numbers.
Are there any past elections that actually compare to 2020 when it comes to the level of interest, the level of voting?
Yeah, I mean, there are other historic elections. 1968 was a little odd in the 20th century in that you reached almost 60% voting levels, which is unusual for the 20th century. 2008, I think the overall voting was about 57%. People felt during the war in Iraq and the end of the Bush presidency that the stakes were very high. So we have had elections like this. We haven't had a presidential election in the middle of a pandemic, just to add to that sense of urgency.
Where are you on this question of what's at stake in this election? Some are calling it the most important in U.S. history.
All presidential elections, we don't have that many of them, are historic by definition. But some are more historic than others. And for me, this fits in the 1860, 1932, 1968, 1980 category. It's going to say a lot about a reckoning that the nation is having with Trumpian conservatism. The Republican Party that President Trump has exposed and promoted, today American voters decide, is this a kind of leadership that's worthy of having 4 more years in power or not? And I think that's a big question that makes this pretty significant in terms of where we are and the kinds of stresses our democratic institutions will face in the next few years.
We're expecting a lot of legal challenges in some key states if the vote is as close as polls are indicating it might be. That is not unusual in a close election, but are you reminded of past election days where there was also a high level of anxiety over lawsuits or disputed results?
Yeah, I mean, we've had elections like 1876 or 2000, famously, for contemporary listeners, where this played out in the courts, it played out in Congress, it played out as a challenge over recounting ballots and counting ballots. And it looks like that might be what we have today. We'll see what happens as the day unfolds. What's different is all the advanced discussion of it, the memories of 2000, I think, have shaped what people are anticipating. And the president's own words, where he's raising threats about challenging the votes, is different than certainly the 2000 election. And we've seen real challenges already, like in Texas, where Republicans tried to invalidate a legitimate vote. So when you have all that before Election Day arrives, the anxiety is going to be much higher than even those other ones.
Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. As always, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
There's so much to watch for today, not just the outcome of the election returns, but the record-breaking number of people voting. And with that, the thousands of lawyers on standby to march into courts throughout the country to make certain ballots get counted or excluded. To parse out what we should expect tonight and what we should be watching for, we have with us Pam Fessler, NPR's national correspondent covering voting issues. And Pam, more than 100 million votes have been cast before Election Day. This, of course, is extraordinary, but also complicates return results because different states have different rules about early ballot counting, correct?
That's right, Tanya. First, you know, we have the sheer number of mail-in ballots. Out of that 100 million, almost 65 million are mail-in. And they take a long time to count. It can be very time-consuming. And while some states have allowed the election officials to start processing them, you know, as soon as they were received, others didn't. And in fact, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, the officials there weren't even allowed to start processing them until this morning, which means, you know, they couldn't even open the envelopes. States also have very different rules over when absentee or mail-in ballots have to arrive in order to still count. And more than half the states allow ballots that arrive sometime after Election Day to count, as long as they were sent by Election Day. And so, for example, you know, Michigan will only count ballots that arrive by today, but North Carolina voters have until November 12th to get their ballots in, you know, as long as they're postmarked by today. So that means, you know, those states we're going to have counting going on for quite a bit, quite a while.
Yeah, you're talking about Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, and so many others, as you said. You know, President Trump has already threatened legal challenges to some ballots that arrive past poll closing time tonight. What sort of legal challenges could actually exist for those late arriving ballots?
Well, I think we could see a number of things. I think it all depends on just how close the results are. I mean, if the margin is wide in any of these states, then I think the talk about going to court is just going to kind of disappear. But if it's tight, there could be challenges to two things. It could be challenges like to individual mail-in ballots, for example, you know, whether or not they arrived on time, but also whether they had the right signatures or witnesses if they were required in particular states. And in some states, you know, that only require mail-in ballots to be postmarked by Election Day, there could be challenges on whether or not the postmark is actually clear enough or is even included on the envelope. Sometimes it isn't. And then we also had these, you know, two recent court decisions that left open the door for other absentee ballots to be rejected. The Supreme Court allowed Pennsylvania to continue accepting mail-in ballots until Friday, but said that any received between November 3rd and Friday should be set aside just in case they're challenged. And there was a similar decision by a federal appeals court in Minnesota. So we will see what happens to those ballots. And actually, I'm sorry, the Supreme Court didn't require Pennsylvania to set them aside, but the state agreed to do that just in case there is a legal challenge.
I see. Wow, there's so much to watch for and keep track of.
Right.
Overall, how has the voting process, you feel like, gone this election cycle? I know that's an unfair question because today is the day.
Right. Well, although actually what we've been hearing so far today, things seem to be going fairly smoothly. I mean, they're sort of the typical problems, like, you know, long lines in places, a few places, equipment has malfunctioned, but they have paper ballot backups in those places. So right now things are going fairly smoothly, but, you know, the day is young. But I mean, overall, this election has been extraordinary. I mean, there have been challenges that nobody even thought about, you know, between the pandemic pandemic and this huge shift to mail-in voting, the delays with the Postal Service that caused all these concerns by voters about whether or not their ballots will get in on time, and many not getting in on time. We've also had this extraordinary level of legal activity with both parties challenging the current rules, mostly over mail-in balloting, and just how much access voters should have. So that's led to a lot of confusion, a lot of last-minute changes. And we also have civil unrest that's going on, and this great partisan divide, which has led, you know, to fears and concerns about, you know, intimidation and possible violence at the polls, which at the moment we actually haven't seen anything. So, you know, definitely that's very good. But officials are definitely on the watch. And on top of that, we also have, you know, President Trump, who has been spreading a lot of disinformation about voting and whether or not there's a lot of fraud. And that has also complicated, you know, and challenged election officials. So if that makes it even more extraordinary that 100 million people have already voted.
Pam, with the 30 seconds I have with you, what lessons do you think you'll be taking into future elections?
Well, I think one is money. Local election officials, you know, the offices are completely underfunded. And they have had to do so much this year because with not enough money. And I think that's, you know, going to be a big issue going forward. And then just also mail-in voting, just getting the rules straightened and clarified in advance, because I think people are going to be using mail-in voting a lot more from now on.
That's Pam Fessler, NPR's national correspondent covering voting issues. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's go to Michigan now, where Senator Kamala Harris is spending part of the day making one final case to residents of Detroit to get out and vote. Voters in Michigan have already cast 3.1 million votes leading up to Election Day, and another 2 million are expected to vote in person today. Michigan, of course, is a contested state that in 2016, President Trump won by just under 11,000 votes. And today, law enforcement is on high alert. According to a recent report from the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, Michigan is one of the top five likeliest states to experience election-related violence. And in cities like Detroit, big box stores like Marshall's are already bracing for unrest by boarding up windows and limiting store hours. For more, let's bring in Detroit Police Chief James Craig. Chief, thank you so much for joining us on what I'm sure is a very busy day for you.
Yeah, very busy. Thanks, Tanya, for having me on today. But very optimistic. This is going to be an uneventful day, other than people are going to come out on this beautiful Detroit fall day and vote.
Well, I want to ask you a little bit more about this. So I know a big effort is underway to make certain that people can cast their ballots safely. But this is a potentially fraught issue in Michigan. The courts have ruled people are allowed to bring their guns with them to the polls. And some believe the show of firearms could be seen as a form of voter intimidation. What's the protocol in place if you get reports of voter intimidation at the polls?
Well, certainly, if we get any reports, and so far I'm getting hourly reports, and I'm going to be out going to different polling locations around the city. We've got no reports, but certainly if, in fact, we get a call regarding voter intimidation or voter suppression, we'll take appropriate action.
It's great to hear that you're optimistic and you received no intelligence that there is something happening later today, because we do know that there were these far-right extremist groups like the ones who were plotting to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer last month. I want to talk with you, though, about some of the protocols and steps that many places in Detroit are taking in light of what they expect to be violence later on in the day. So stores like Marshall's are boarding up their windows. This is happening throughout the country as people brace for potentially violent demonstrations. They're just not confident that police can keep them safe. Have you seen an election before where this is such a concern?
I can say I probably haven't seen an election in my professional career with this kind of concern. However, and I'll go back into the 10 weeks of protests, and I might remind you that Detroit really was a beacon, a bright light in this country. There were many cities that were burning, there was looting, violent protests nightly in some cities. That didn't happen here in Detroit. This community supports this police department, and they don't want to see any violence. And certainly if there is any inciting of violence, more than likely it'll come from outside agitators, like what we saw over the 10 weeks. But I'm telling you, we are not hearing it. And so far, polls have been open since 7 o'clock. We're not seeing it. And we're going to have a great day today in Detroit.
The polls in Michigan close at 8 p.m. tonight. And unlike other states that started counting absentee ballots early, Michigan is only allowed to start today, despite receiving three times as many absentee ballots than in the past. How will you ensure a sustained atmosphere of calm as the election workers do their job?
We'll be visible. We certainly won't be sitting at locations, but we'll be visible. And if necessary, we will respond in.
We know that earlier this year, as much as 20% of your force was out due to coronavirus concerns. You yourself actually contracted the virus. Do you feel you have enough staff, not only for today, but just looking to the future about the status of your department and what you want to be for Detroiters, the agency that they call when they feel like they need help?
Absolutely. You know, at one point in March, April, this department was ravaged by COVID. As you pointed out, I'm a COVID survivor, along with 380 members of the police department. We were able to make some adjustments from our support units, and we never lost traction in providing services to community. So I know the capabilities of this organization.
Mm-hmm. Any final words for Detroiters today?
Enjoy this beautiful fall day. If you haven't voted, get out and vote. That's it.
Detroit Police Chief James Craig, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
In Harris County, Texas today, there is still one drive-through polling place. Some Republicans tried to get all 10 of them shut down. A court rejected that challenge, but after comments in court and concerns about possible future challenges, the Harris County clerk decided to close all but one of these voting places. About 127,000 early votes have already been cast at these drive-through locations. Andrew Schneider is politics and government reporter for Houston Public Media. And Andrew, for people who haven't been following this drama, there were 10 of these places, as we said, set up for people who wanted more safety in the pandemic. And then some Republicans tried to get the 127,000 votes already cast there thrown out. So remind us, what did the court say about that?
Well, the courts basically didn't rule in favor of or against drive-through voting. They just ruled that the plaintiffs didn't have standing to sue. The judge said, in fact, that he might support the plaintiffs if the Fifth Circuit reversed his ruling. And in particular, he said that he didn't think tents, which most of the drive-through locations were, qualified as buildings under the Texas Election Code. Polling places have to be held inside a building, according to Texas election law.
Well, that brings us to where we are, because nine of these 10 drive-through places are tents. And so it was the county clerk, Chris Hollins, who said, you know what, let's shut those just so those aren't challenged. I believe the one that's kept open is in the sort of the parking lot, the indoor parking lot of another area. So it's got a ceiling and walls. And the thinking is that at least it'll meet that challenge, that it's a building. But is there still tentativeness about what's going to happen to the votes that are being cast there?
There is, because it's not necessarily the end of the legal fight. The ruling came down from the Fifth Circuit from a three-judge panel, so the plaintiffs are still considering whether to appeal to the full bench of 17 judges on the Fifth Circuit, what they call an en banc hearing. And, of course, there's always the possibility that they could appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah. And by the way, you know, who are these people suing? It's not the Republican Party.
No, it's not. The lead plaintiff is a man by the name of Stephen Hotze. He's a wealthy Republican activist. He's been behind a lot of the political lawsuits over the past several years, including several challenges to Governor Greg Abbott's executive orders on COVID-19 safety. The other three are Republican candidates from around the Houston area, including a current member of the state legislature.
Okay, so we'll wait to see what happens there. You know, over 100,000 ballots so far and more people voting today. in a state that had incredibly high early turnout, Texas, 9.7 million voted, according to the Elections Project, more than the total number of votes cast in 2016. So what are you seeing today?
Well, so far here in Harris County, we've already had 75,000 people show up to vote in the first 4 hours of Election Day. I've heard projections for today bringing total turnout as high as 70%. That would be absolutely unheard of for a state like Texas, which historically has had very low turnout. It's well outside anything that we've seen before. But even with a modest turnout, as you said, we've already seen 9.7 million voting. Yeah. It's more than likely we'll see something well past 10 million, possibly as high as 11 million.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, we will keep a close eye on Texas, as everyone is. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In Lincoln's inaugural address, he implored Americans on the cusp of civil war to find their better angels. They couldn't. Can we? Well, there's a good chance you're crossing your arms and saying no. We've seen people assaulted, even in a couple of cases killed, when they asked others to wear masks. One Trump supporter saw his huge campaign billboards burn along with his farm equipment. Some worry now about civil war. Well, in 2016, a bipartisan group came together to find their better angels. That was their name. Their credo, we reject the normalizing of this extreme polarization. We say no to the breakdown of social life that it brings. They're now called Braver Angels. They help people talk across the political divide. John Wood Jr. is one of their leaders, also a former chair of the Republican Party of Los Angeles County. And John, we understand there were very small beginnings in a barn in 2016 using marriage counseling techniques to bring Republicans and Democrats together. Explain.
Well, so we have a sense of who the other folks are that gets filtered through to us through a partisan media landscape that becomes sort of unrelatable to us. And so we have something called a stereotypes exercise, where each side of the conversation has the opportunity to list out the stereotypes that they see the other side is having about them. But each side gets the opportunity to reflect on what kernels of truth there may be in those stereotypes as well. So conservatives will oftentimes say that we are not racist folks by and large, but there are some racists who attach themselves to our party. We should not make this space a comfortable one for them. Whereas folks on the left will frequently say, look, we're not people who want the government to run everything, and we're not people who mooch off the state, but you have some people who game the system, some people who take advantage of welfare, this, that, or the other. We had folks who were devout evangelical Christians becoming deep friends with people who were Muslims and immigrants, people with dramatically differing politics. There are techniques that we can use that can allow us to communicate across these divides while maximizing our ability to preserve our relationships as Americans.
Give another example.
If you find yourself talking about politics, it is helpful for us to frame our political opinions not as truth statements, but as I statements. If you go into a conversation with somebody who's on the other side of the fence as you are, and you say, well, it's just a fact that Donald Trump has had the best economy of all time, or it's just a fact that Barack Obama has done more for healthcare than any Republican would ever dream, it has the effect of putting the other person on the defensive, to where psychologically what that other person feels that she or he has to do is to respond, to save face, to be able to win the argument, to protect their team. They are no longer listening. Rather, it is better to approach these conversations by saying, well, in my view, President Trump has been good for the economy. Or from what I've learned, it seems that Barack Obama has really pushed healthcare forward in America. And I think that Joe Biden will build on that. When you introduce the aspect of your own subjectivity, you signal a certain humility that shows you're also opening up the space for that person's input to be heard.
How about expressing how you feel? Because Michael Sandel has a terrific book on merit and how merit is oversold, first of all. And by that, he means this idea of you have to go to an Ivy League college. That's what success means. When two-thirds of the country have not gone to a four-year school, and many of them are followers of Donald Trump, and clearly telling pollsters that they are made to feel less than. If you're on that side of the Trump side of the equation, can you say that? You make me feel like I don't count?
If you make it with humility, as opposed to lashing out in anger, as opposed to saying, well, you know, you're some, you know, highfalutin college professor, you've got your fancy degree, but just because you've got your degree doesn't mean that you're not totally stupid. You know, there's a way to be able to make that point. Now, one thing I should say, though, is that there are some times and occasions where it probably is best to simply maintain the silence and to maintain the peace that way. And it just depends on the context of the interaction. Another Yes. very important one is paraphrasing. Being able to paraphrase the statements that the other party in the conversation makes in a way that reflects the language they might actually use to say it. And so if you're speaking with a conservative who's in favor of lowering taxes, the wrong way to be able to characterize that position would be to say, okay, so you think that by giving greedy rich people more money, that somehow is going to make life better for poor people, right? More likely than not, if you recite that opinion by saying, okay, I hear you saying that by allowing people to keep more of their own money, they'll be able to invest more in the economy, and that will create more jobs and more opportunities for everybody, including lower income folks. You will continue to disagree with that statement, but you will have said it in a way that accurately represents how it is that person really feels. One thing that is powerful is being armed with stories pulled from your own experience. Stories are so often so much more powerful and profound than simple rational arguments.
So would that involve, I'm thinking of someone who maybe comes from an area that's been devastated by COVID-19. They had maybe relatives who were on ventilators. They had maybe new people who didn't make it. And then there's swaths of the country who don't believe COVID-19 is that big a deal. Again, because they've been told that. Would that mean just telling a personal story about witnessing COVID-19?
Oh, absolutely. Being able to tell a story pulled from your community about, you know, how it is that the consequences of not following guidelines has impacted your life adds context to the political or social position that you have. It shows that you are a human being.
And that other person you're speaking with, by the way, might tell you a tearful story about losing a family business, you know, because of a shutdown. Can you just tick through a couple of other techniques?
One thing that is powerful is being able to reflect on the ways in which your side may be falling short of the standards that you hold for, or the ways in which your own argument might not be 100% spot on. So if you say, for instance, you're arguing for single payer healthcare, let's say hypothetically, and you were to say, look, it's my feeling that the federal government is the best vehicle to guarantee health coverage for all Americans. But I totally think that it's possible to expect too much from government. But I do think that on balance, it would allow us to accomplish the aim of ensuring healthcare and ensuring quality of life for the most Americans. If you introduce humility and some degree of reflection to your political point of view, then the other side is much more likely to take the fact that you are being honest seriously. In order for us to truly build relationships and depolarize across the divide, we have to be able to keep track of our thinking about conservatives or conservatives thinking about progressives in a way that does not allow the stereotype to become the fixture in terms of how we see them.
John Wood, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. Real pleasure.
Well, this is reminding us of a story from 2018. Liberals from Massachusetts, led by Paula Green, reached out to conservatives from Kentucky, including Gwen Johnson. Filled with fear, they said in time, they fell in love. Here's part of our talk. We'll hear from Paula, who is Jewish, but start with Gwen, talking about how eye-opening it was to hear Jewish people talk about the Holocaust.
Well, you know, we had in the early days, the Cofields were a melting pot of all nationalities who came here to work. They learned to live side by side and developed a brotherhood. And the United Mine Workers of America was never segregated. And so just to meet the ones who had that history from the Holocaust, it was a rich, rich experience of compassion and love. I've always been aware of the Holocaust, but I could really sympathize when they began to talk about the family experiences around that. it was rich to be among them. It was rich.
Two things came for us. One is the tremendous pride that people had in mining. World War II, the miners were heroes. They couldn't even be drafted because they had to stay home and keep mining coal for the war effort. And the other thing we heard was a tremendous danger and death. People talk about husbands, fathers, brothers, sons dying in the mines, either from black lung or from boulders that fall. So I think the compassion built up on both sides.
You know, we didn't want to let them leave. We wanted to keep them.
That's Paula Green and Gwen Johnson of the group Hands Across the Hills. In 2018, they're still talking. We'll catch up after Election Day. We also spoke with John Wood Jr. of the bipartisan civil discourse group Braver Angels.
France, Germany, and Ireland are under new pandemic restrictions as Europe tries to contain the latest surge in coronavirus cases. But schools are staying open, unlike in many parts of the U.S. where students are mostly learning remotely. We wanted to take a look at the research on the virus in schools, and to do that, we have Dr. David Rubin, a pediatrician and infectious disease expert at the University of Pennsylvania. Doctor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Doctor, what does the research tell us about schools, particularly elementary schools, and whether COVID has been spreading there?
Well, you know, since August and September, as many schools are starting to open under a variety of different plans, we're now aggregating a lot of contact tracing evidence from across the country. So it's not simply from overseas. And what we're finding is that the multi-layered safety plans we've developed with schools that have emphasized masking, distancing while at school, keeping sick kids out of the school, doing hygiene and disinfection and ventilation, you know, that these types of things, when layered together, have actually prevented what we call linked transmission from occurring frequently in schools. In fact, we've seen very infrequent evidence of spread within the school day, particularly among the elementary age children. So it's actually given us greater confidence that schools can stay open at much higher incidence rates than we had known about earlier in the summer.
And we should be clear, it's not that children don't get the virus, but they are far less likely to get a serious case of the virus. But how risky is this virus for kids, and are they less likely to spread it?
Well, let's be very clear. Kids can transmit this virus. So, you know, my previous comments really focused on the fact that these safety protocols actually are extremely effective. They're very similar to the ones we have in healthcare to prevent transmission during the workday. And we know that younger children are inefficient drivers. We see less symptomatic infection and certainly severe infection among younger kids. I think, you know, where we have greater challenges is when we get to the middle school or high school age level. As you get closer to adulthood, it's not a binary, you just become an adult and suddenly you're prone to symptomatic infection. You'll see more symptomatic infection in the adolescence for sure. And then you have sort of higher risk behaviors that are associated with middle and high school. You have a lot more social contacts at parties that are taking place outside the school day. And then you have kids moving between classes. All that makes the middle school and high school level a little bit more challenging, and that differentiates from an elementary school situation where if you have good adherence to these protocols, you can actually do really well.
I mean, based on all of what you're saying, when you see a number of European countries imposing new virus restrictions but keeping schools open, do you think that's a good idea? And is it something the U.S. could replicate?
I actually strongly agree that, you know, as we're seeing rates really start to surge now as we move into wintertime, we're likely to see increasing restrictions again, particularly as healthcare capacity begins to become exhausted in many regions. And learning from what we're now seeing in the schools, I think that this time around, we should be trying to think about more surgical restrictions that would preserve our school reopenings as long as possible, so long as we're not seeing linked transmission in the schools. And so I would agree that the approach that we're seeing in Europe that would look at other types of restrictions while keeping our schools open would be the prudent way to go.
There's also the safety of the teachers, though. I mean, many teachers' unions say it's not safe for teachers to go back. How should we be thinking about the risks to adults who work in these environments?
Well, the key is whether we're seeing any evidence of linked transmission. Our guidelines actually changed over the last month to emphasize less a number and more about the relationship with your health department and how well you think the contact tracing is establishing that teachers are safe and that students are safe within the context of a school day. Most of the transmission we're seeing is happening outside the school day. And I really do think that, you know, to the teachers out there, we are establishing pretty good confidence that if these protocols are implemented well, and that's a big if. I mean, if they're not being implemented well, we've seen transmission. But if they're being implemented well and teachers are spacing themselves out from students and they're wearing their masks, we should see very little in-school transmission to teachers.
Doctor, one other thing that I'm thinking a lot about is the other risks to children that need to be weighed here. I have two children. I'm thinking about what happens to them developmentally, their education, by not being in school. What are some risks to children when we talk about this issue of kids in school during the pandemic?
I mean, surely you have to weigh the socio-emotional risk. I mean, even though we're now at a phase where we're seeing testing positivity rise to extreme levels, that it may make sense to revert to some distance learning, particularly for your older kids, for a couple of weeks to let this wave kind of come through, at least stabilize a bit. The socio-emotional risks are high on our mind. You know, you're often balancing the difference between bad and worse here. And I think as we gain confidence in our school protocols, it emboldens us to recognize that if we are more assured of the safety in these school environments, that we have a real need to really push to try to keep these schools open and find ways for kids to remain resilient through the remainder of the pandemic.
That's Dr. David Rubin, a pediatrician and infectious disease expert at the University of Pennsylvania and Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. Doctor, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.